We go. Court to the Clown. Putting in progress. Okay, our topic for tonight is Johann Eisenmenger. Johann Andreas Eisenmenger, who you probably never heard of unless you studied Jewish history in college. But he's nonetheless a very, very important figure. We would be remiss if we didn't have a session on Eisenmenger and a course on anti-Semitism. He lived 1654 to 1704. He was a German, as his name might indicate. And he was the author of Andenktes Judentum, Judaism Unmasked, which was a 2,000-page, two-volume work combing through all of rabbinic literature, trying to find unpleasant things in that literature that could then be used against Judaism and the Jewish people. He wasn't the first one to do this, and he wasn't the last one to do this, but he was the best at it, okay? And it was a product of years and years of study. So
he must have had some background.
Well, we'll find out exactly how he studied. So Eisenmenger was a professor at Heidelberg University, and he was the author of the most influential anti-Semitic text in history, up until basically either Mein Kampf or the Protocols. He spent 19 years posing as a convert or a potential convert to Judaism, enabling him to study Torah with Jewish teachers, with rabbinical authorities. He studied in Frankfurt and he studied in Amsterdam. 19 years. He even married a Jew, or sired children from a Jewess. Not exactly clear whether they were married, but he had children, and these children play a role later on in the story. So we don't know exactly whether he ever underwent a giur, a conversion, whether he took a little snip and went into the mikveh or not, but he studied for a very long time. I don't know if anybody checked. Okay. No. His work was printed in 1699, but the Jews tried to block circulation of the work. It was written in German, and it became popular in a condensed version that was printed 50 years later and would influence other anti-Semitic writers in the 19th and early 20th centuries. His father was a minor government official. He was a gifted student. Clearly, if he could write a 2,000-page book about a subject matter that is not his own religion, he must have been a fairly intelligent guy. He was sent to Amsterdam to study. He mastered Hebrew, and he was interested in all things Jewish. He listened to the sermons of Rabbi David Lida, who was a Lithuanian rabbi who was the rabbi of the Ashkenaz community in Amsterdam. And the rabbi in Amsterdam had a very passionate anti-Christian tone to his sermons. So here you have a goy sort of passing himself off as a Jew, trying to uncover the deepest, darkest secrets about Judaism, listening to a guy from the pulpit spew all sorts of anti-Christian invective. He's loving every minute of it. This is what he came for. Okay.
Did he ever cross paths with Espinoza?
No.
During the same time.
Spinoza died before. But Eisenmenger was in his early 20s. They wouldn't have crossed paths yet. So Eisenmenger was deeply offended by this. Then he came across Gehrim, converts from Christianity to Judaism. And he wondered to himself, how could it be that people converted to Judaism? What do they see in this religion? How can I prevent this from ever happening again? So he devoted himself to an expose of Judaism so that no Christian would ever again be attracted to this base and gutter religion. There's a small trend of Jewish anti-Christian literature in our past. For example, the Toldos Yeshu, the stories of Jesus. And as far as we're concerned, that's like a minor issue within our literature. What do we study? We study the Talmud, the Bible, the Poskim. We're not all that interested in Toldos Yeshu. It's just for fun, you know, for entertainment value. But as far as Eisenmenger was concerned, he saw this as like a central focus of Judaism to bash the other religions and Bedafka Christianity. In fact, the Toldos Yeshu and those sorts of books are really the voice of the oppressed, meaning the Jews are a beleaguered minority. The Christians are the vast, you know, dominant majority. And sometimes the minority, you know, says some things that, you know, under cover of darkness that they really shouldn't say, or they would want to get away with it and not have nobody hear. And this guy is about to ferret out all this information. Eisenmenger went through Shas several times. Several times. He did Daf Yomi a bunch of times. Now, he found the handful of Jesus passages, but also a lot of hyperbole that was never meant to be taken literally. So Joanne's asking in the chat, did he call Judaism a gutter religion? He called it much worse, but yes, in German, something along those lines. Superstitious religion, a trash religion, he said. So Eisenmenger is taking all this hyperbolic stuff in the Talmud out of context. We're going to see specifically what kind of material, what lines of the Talmud. But I ask you, for the crowd of you, for the three of you here in person, as opposed to the 43 of you at home, give me a line in the Gemara that a goy would say, oh, that's terrible. But a Jew wouldn't think really twice about it.
Goy's
makabel
the mitzvahs, they deserve death.
Okay, good. So Norman says, Goy she shavas, if a goy keeps Shabbos, he's deserving of death. Or Goy she lama Torah, chayav misa. If a goy studies Torah, deserving of death. Was it really? Yes, in the tefillah you have a mishtachalim lehevav arik, which was a long-standing controversy dating back 1,000 years. But you have passages in the Gemara that speak about, oh, Chayav Misa, Mischayav Benavsho, he deserves to die, he's sacrificed his life. But nobody's actually getting killed. And yet, if you don't know that, or if you come to see this literature with a malevolent hermeneutic, with an evil eye, you want to find something bad about it, you see that line and you say, oh, they're going to kill us. Okay, so what happened? Well, Eisenmenger wasn't killed by the Jews, but his children claimed that the Jewish efforts to suppress his books caused him an early death. We'll see exactly what happened. So Eisenmenger cites 182 Hebrew books, many Yiddish books, and 8 works by former Jews, by Meshum Adim. So he's got a pretty big library. I mean, your average Jew in America today doesn't have 182 Hebrew books. In 1699, the book went to its first printing, and Benctus Judentum, Judaism Unmasked, and 2,500 copies were printed. But the Jews petitioned the local elector, meaning the local government leader, because this is, remember, this is Germany before the unification, so every principality has an elector, to suppress the book. They were successful in getting the Emperor Leopold to suppress the book. Why? Well, in part because rich Jews complained, certain court Jews like Oppenheimer and Wertheimer complained, but also because the Jesuits complained that Eisenmenger had an anti-Catholic streak to him as well, that this is a Lutheran writer with an anti-Catholic trend. So here the Jews and the Jesuits are getting together to try to suppress what they think is a really nasty work bound to cause them a lot of trouble. Yes, and even Eisenmenger will agree with that. We'll get to that in the end. What are his practical suggestions about what to happen to the Jews? It's one thing to write a book exposing the Talmud for all of its nefarious features, but then you have to ask, well, what does Eisenmenger want? And the answer is not genocide, or for that matter, even exile. We'll see. So Eisenmenger's supporters don't like the fact that his book was suppressed. Remember, he put 20 years into writing this thing. I'm sure he put a lot of money into writing this thing. And he wants it to become a bestseller. He didn't write it so it could be under lock and key in some archive somewhere. Well, what happened? He has his supporters, and this happens even after his death, print 3,000 copies, falsely claiming that they were published in Königsberg. Why Königsberg? Because that's in Kaliningrad, beyond the borders of the empire. The Habsburg Empire, the Holy Roman Empire, doesn't control that territory. So if you put on the front page, the title page, it was printed in Königsberg, then all of a sudden it's kosher and the emperor can't suppress it. So the King of Prussia really printed it in Berlin, but falsely claimed it was printed in Königsberg. Okay. Now, Eisenmenger, as I said, fathered children from a Jewish woman who may have herself converted to Christianity. He died in 1704 at the age of 50, with his book still not yet released. He died of apoplexy. And the kids claimed that he was devastated by the fact that he put all this effort in and didn't see the light of day, and that killed him. that killed him. So they blame the Jews for his death. Well, all right, okay. Now, his children sued the Jewish community, claiming that Jewish efforts to suppress the first volume had injured their father, and the court case went on for 40 years. 40 years. That's even longer than a court case involving one of my former congregants. Now, the kids got nothing in the end. Anti-Semitism was Eisenmenger's religion, the driving force of his life. The double life that he led for two decades was all to expose the truth, so to speak. He was like our Moloch, in the sense that this is his whole, every fiber of his being is to undo the Jews. All right. Well, okay. Well, all right. It's true. Now he.
How did he make a living?
He was a university professor. He taught. And in fact, he was a fairly prestigious professor at that. He almost. He taught theology, Hebrew studies, theology. Now he almost went to Israel. He almost went to Eretz Yisrael, but his sponsor died in 1680 when Eisenmenger was in, you know, getting his paperwork together and his COVID tests, you know, to go, you know, halal. So the trip got canceled. Now, anti-Christian polemics had been printed in Amsterdam. And remember, he's learning in Amsterdam Judaism under the cover of whatever identity he was claiming. And the Shla, the Shnilchot Habrit of Horowitz, had said that Samael, the king of the devils, is really the celestial representative of Christianity. So he hears this, he hears all sorts of nasty stuff about Christianity coming out of the Jews of Amsterdam, or the rabbis of Amsterdam, and he wants to do something to strike back. There was the criticism or the accusation that Eisenmenger fabricated his sources. That if he's writing a 2,000-page book saying that Judaism has all sorts of unpleasant things to say about other religions, well, maybe he's making it up. And who's going to know the difference? Do you know the Medrash Tanchuma by heart? Do you know the Medrash Seichel Tov by heart? No. All right? So if Jews don't know it by heart, and the Goyim don't know it by heart, maybe he could fabricate sources and it'll pad the stats in his book. Well, the scholars have determined, and Jacob Katz being the number one scholar on Eisenmenger, determined that he did not fabricate anything. Every single source was real. Some were badly misinterpreted because Eisenmenger was not a yeshiva boy, you know, at heart. He was an outsider learning the literature as an outsider. So he was bound to misunderstand a few things here and there. Maybe, you know, the Jastrow wasn't printed yet. But everything was real. He borrowed from the works of the Meshumad Samuel Friedrich Brenz, who had written Jewish Cast-Off Snakeskin, a very famous works, the snakeskin work of 1614. And so he built upon existing works that were anti-Jewish, but his was far bigger and all-encompassing, and it really did require a tremendous degree of scholarship. Now, Eisenmenger called for restricting Jewish economic liberties, banning Jews from writing criticism of Christianity, limiting the synagogues and the Beit Din and the rabbis. But what did I not say? I didn't say expulsion, and I didn't say genocide. We'll see why. He hoped to shock Christians, free thinkers, and even enlightened Jews. Basically, his target audience is a wide swath of the population to get them to understand how terrible Judaism is, but especially the free thinkers who might be inclined to dabble in Judaism, and the enlightened Jews who might be inclined to abandon their ancestral faith for something better, as far as he's concerned. Now, although he pursued anti-Semitism with a scholarly bent, he did believe in the veracity of ritual murder charges, well poisoning charges, desecration of the host charges, all the shtusim that we've learned about for the last month and a half, none of which was true. He believed it. The tendency up until now was the stupid people believe things and the popes all say, well, it isn't really true. Don't persecute the Jews. Eisenmenger's a big scholar, but he believes it. But why? It's all the starting premise. Well, it's the starting premise. He believes the worst. He finds support for that in the literature, and it just reinforces his initial assumptions. Well, because bad people followed up and did bad things to our people as a result. Now, so he believed that he wanted people to know that Judaism was a barbarous and superstitious religion. He also believed that the Germans were a distinct nation of Gentiles descended from the Kna'anim, and that the Jews were trying to destroy Germany in fulfillment of Deuteronomy 7:16. How do you like that? Meaning that the Kna'anim ran away from Eretz Canaan, you know, over 3,000 years ago, and they went on the boats and they went up to the Italian peninsula, up into the Germanic lands. And so the Jewish people, B'nai Yisrael, believe up until this very day, says Eisenmenger, that they have to kill to wipe out the descendants of the Kna'anim, and we, the Germans, are the Kna'anim. So it's not just Jews versus Christians, it's Jews versus Germans. Right. Now, Rabbi Samson Wertheimer, as I said, successfully petitioned Emperor Leopold to suppress the book. Why were they so interested in suppressing this book as opposed to any other book? I mean, yes, it was big and scary, but it's because there had been a year earlier in 1699 riots in the Habsburg realm, including in Vienna. And so the thinking was this book will set off a whole slew of riots all over the Germanic lands, and a lot of people will be killed. Not that we're worried 200 years from now the Nazis will read it. Yeah, that happened. They thought in the here and now there's going to be a problem of mass death. There was negotiation going on between the Jewish community and Eisenmenger over the price for him to voluntarily suppress his own work. So it's not just that they're petitioning the government to shut it down. They talk to Eisenmenger. What do we have to give you to put this, you know, in the basement and never take it out again, or to burn all the copies? The Jews offered 12,000 florins. Eisenmenger wanted 30,000 florins. So nothing ever came of these negotiations, but of course Eisenmenger died. Now,
but that proves the point is Jews being money grubbing and also buying out any.
Yeah, well, listen, you can't win. You, no matter what you do, you're damned. You try to suppress it with money. Okay, so now Frederick William I, who was the King of Prussia, as I said, had the next run of the book published, 3,000 copies in 1711. And this book was not so widely read because it was too cumbersome, too bulky. But the condensed version printed in 1748 and the Talmud Jew written by Rowling in 1871 basically recapitulated all the material, and so the stuff was widely known. Even if people didn't actually read Eisenmenger's book cover to cover, I would imagine almost nobody ever did that, still the content was circulated. Someone else, about a half century later. Now, Jacob Katz made the following point. When it was published, Judaism Unmasked could have been seen and was seen by some optimists as the last flare-up denunciation based upon traditional Jewish-Christian schism, meaning this is a medieval work, but the medieval times are coming to an end, and this will be the last we hear of theologians trashing our faith and calling us out for things that appear in our holy books. But the truth of the matter is that rationalism did not bridge the schism. It just changed its character. And next week we'll discuss Voltaire, how Voltaire also hates the Jews. So just because we're moving away from the centrality of religion in European life doesn't mean anti-Semitism is going to go away. Now, Wertheimer and Oppenheimer did delay the publication, but only delayed it. Bottom line is it got out. Eisenmenger was well acquainted with all of Jewish literature. Halacha, Agadah, Kabbalah, Philosophia, Musar, everything. He knew any text that a good Jewish scholar would have known, he knew, or at least he had seen. He may not have appreciated its full flavor, but at least he had seen it. And he could cite it and put it in a book of quotations. So he was especially keen on tendentiously interpreting sources. Of course, he didn't think he was doing so tendentiously, but we would say so in hindsight. He wanted to show the immorality of Jewish law as it determined Jewish behavior towards Gentiles. The key thing is Jewish-Gentile relations. What does the Talmud say about what we, the Jews, ought to do in our conduct with the outside world? He said it's foolish belief, wicked laws, gross anthropomorphism, and a distortion of divine attributes, that the Talmud condones deceit, theft, and murder of Gentiles. Well, how did he reach these conclusions? You know, if we don't think that, why did he think that? So the answer is, this is the key point for tonight, that the Talmud has, and the Midrashic literature, has all sorts of statements that are made over almost a millennium, over centuries at least. Different opinions, different authorities, in different social circumstances, different political circumstances. And what might have made sense in attacking the pagan of 2,300 years ago or 2,100 years ago didn't necessarily make sense in describing the behaviors or the interaction of Jews with Muslims or Christians 1,500 years ago. But it's all there on the paper. And unless you know when a particular line was written and in what context it was written, you could think it applies to all Gentiles, including yourself if you're Eisenmenger. So, well, it's a big problem, okay? Now, the frame of reference was that the Jews are versus the Umot HaOlam. That if you read the Talmud carefully, it's Jews, Yisrael versus Umot HaOlam. Are distinctions drawn between the various types of Umot HaOlam?
Yeah.
No. It's not. Now, that's in the earliest strata of rabbinic literature. But while the Bible and Talmud remain authoritative, eventually such distinctions are drawn between different categories of non-Jew. But if you just read the earliest sources and you say, well, it's a blanket statement, then you could say, well, the Jews hate every goy and want to kill him.
So do you make a distinction of from when a goy that follows the Sheva Mitzvahs B'nai Noah and a goy that doesn't? We make that distinction.
Okay, good. So Norman is, for those at home, Norman is asking, do we make a distinction between those who follow the Sheva Mitzvahs B'nai Noach and those who don't? And the answer is yes, of course we do. The question is, will we say about European society that as a collective, it is roughly observing the seven Noahide laws or not? And if you say not, then what are the consequences in terms of how Jews should interact with those Gentiles? Or shall you say, well, on the whole, they're an enlightened society and they're not the barbarous pagans of yesteryear, and so therefore we have to treat them differently. It depends which rabbi you'll ask. But there will be an opinion which is more moderate than the categorical statements of the Talmud. So study of books alone cannot reveal what is part of the living, active Judaism. What is living Judaism? It's what you learn from your parents, and maybe your grandparents, and what you read among the most recent codifiers of the halakha. So what is more relevant in our religion today, the Mishnah Brura or Masechta Yevamos? The Mishnah Brura. Because if you have a religious question, so it was written 120 years ago, it's close enough. We're not deriving daily doses of instruction from the Tosefta on Kilayim, for example. And yet there may be juicy nuggets of information in the Tosefta, but it's not determining our life. So Judaism evolves, and Jacob Katz's point is that Eisenmenger doesn't care about that. Either he doesn't know it, he doesn't accept it, or he just doesn't care. All he wants to know is, what did the earliest sources say, or even the later sources, if they say anything nasty and juicy? And he'll trumpet that as being the be-all and end-all. So every generation, the faith is updated to have, you know, to be livable under new conditions. But Eisenmenger disregards the exegetical homiletical approach of contemporary Jews in favor of what he thinks is a historical approach towards the true meaning of the original sources. Yet in fact, he knows nothing of the historical method. He couldn't tell you the difference between something written in the second century versus the ninth century. He just sees a piece of paper with words on the page. And if it suits his fancy, it fits his narrative, he copies it for the book. There's no real historical awareness on the part of Eisenmenger. He accepted the worst Christian assumptions about Jews, and those guided him in his study of the sources. He thought that Jews had spiritual blindness, and so they will falsify doctrines. This is a key point. You know, everyone likes to think that they engage in religious discourse in good faith. Does the other guy engage in good faith? Well, maybe, but maybe not. So Eisenmenger's approach is the Jews are not engaging in religious discourse in good faith. They're deliberately blinding themselves to the doctrine and then deliberately falsifying the doctrine. He doesn't like certain agadic statements about God. Says in the Talmud, God studies Torah. God puts on a talus. God wears tefillin. What's in God's tefillin? You know, our tefillin has Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad, and Hashem's tefillin has Mika Amcha Yisrael. So Eisenmenger says, God prays, God studies Torah, God wears tefillin. That's a disgrace. You're making a mockery out of an incorporeal being. This is a shanda as far as he's concerned.
Because she said the words Hashem Kelkana. Yeah. How did God be jealous?
Yeah, yeah.
So that over the went with her crazy new
religion. Okay, so what the Jews would say is that these passages of the Talmud are not really to be taken literally, that God wears tefillin and God wears a talus and God studies Torah, but rather that what? We should wear a talus and we should wear a tefillin and we should study Torah. It's an encouragement to do mitzvot. But he doesn't want to see it that way. He wants to take everything super duper literally. Then, yeah. No. Now, Eisenmenger saw this as gross anthropomorphism, and he saw vulgarity in Jewish concepts of the divine. One of the more bizarre pages in the Talmud, in Basra 84b, is the tales of Rabbi Bar Barachana. The stories of Rabbi Bar Barachana, it's like Jack and the Beanstalk kind of stories in the Talmud. And he says, listen, if that's your literature, it shows the foolishness, the worthlessness of the Talmud. You could look it up. You look up Rabbi Bar Barachana. Now, the Mashiach... Okay, good. So what Norman just said was, isn't this true about other religions as well? And the answer is absolutely yes. Johann David Michaelis, a name we spoke about 3-4 years ago when we discussed Moses Mendelssohn and his various machloksim with the theologians of his time in the 1770s. Michaelis was a frenemy of Mendelssohn, was opposed to Jewish emancipation, and in our book would be a bad guy. He said, listen, in Sanctus Eudentum, Judaism Unmasked, it took a lot of effort to write it, but okay, it could be written because religions do that. They say nasty things about other religions. And if we wanted to write one about Lutheranism, we could write that too. Now, the fact of the matter is, it was written about Judaism and it wasn't written about Lutheranism. Why not? Because Judaism can be pushed around. The Jews are the beleaguered minority. So to write a book really savagely attacking them and calling them all sorts of names, you can get away with it. I mean, the emperor might have suppressed it a little bit, but ultimately it got out. But could the Jews write a similar work about Lutheranism? No, the author would be executed. So it's not an equal playing field, but Michaelis conceded, yeah, if we really wanted to write a book about any religion along these lines, we could. We could cherry pick sources that make them look bad, and they would look bad.
He believes, how can I believe in some schmuck coming down from Shammai?
All right. And that I'm not going to repeat for the audience. All right. Now, Jews were believe in the Messiah, in eschatology, in the resurrection. As far as Eisenmenger is concerned, these are all illusory ideas, that there's going to be a Messiah coming in the future who hasn't come previously, that there's going to be an end of days scenario, a Tchias HaMesim. He says, this is all foolishness. You Jews believe in silly things. He thought Jews are commanded to abuse all that is sacred in other religions, especially Christianity. What pasuk in the Torah is supportive of this contention? that Jews are obligated to be abusive of the religious artifacts of other religions. Bingo! Okay, you have to destroy their matzevas and their mizbeach and their bamot. Okay, it appears in the Torah three times. You have to destroy their high places and their altars and their pillars. So yes, it is in the Old Testament and it is in the Talmud and it's in everywhere. Okay, granted, so they're referring to things from the ancient days, not necessarily from today. But as far as Eisenmenger is concerned, well, if you had to destroy the Canaanite idols and high places, you also have to desecrate our host and our wafer and our grape juice. And you do it, and we caught you, and it's all true. That's what he's saying. Well, as for the nature of the Jewish tradition is that the law regulates relations between Jews and other fellow Jews. But what about Jews and those who are not party to the covenant? Einam b'nei brit, you know, the outsider, the goy, the eino Yehudi. Does the moral law of the Bible govern that relationship as well? The answer is maybe a little bit, but not entirely. It's not a universally applicable law.
Charging interest.
Charging interest, good. Okay, so now there are examples of, you know, very aggressive statements in the Talmud that could be taken in a very bad way. Mechiat Amalek, the destruction of the Amalekites. Moridin velo ma'alin. If you find out the minim, the sectarians, you throw them in the pit and you don't elevate them out of the pit. Or for other types of akum of the Kachavim Mazalot, lo ma'alin velo moridin. We don't throw them in the pit, but if they're down in the pit, we don't lift them up. You know, we let them die. So, you know, these are not exactly pleasant things. The halachists read this as having applied previously, but not at the present time. So all these kinds of statements of let them die, kill them actively, that was in the ancient past. We don't do that now. How do we do Mechiyas Amalek now? During the Megillah, we boo Haman. You shake a grogger a little bit. Shaking a grogger is not so terrible. It's not like actually slaughtering a person. Now, when the Jews became a beleaguered minority, nearly all the moral double standards in the law were eliminated. It was not yet absolutely universal because the ghetto conditions did not give the motivations to have an absolutely universal law. But still, the Jews were not taught about their neighbors that they are the Amalekites or the Canaanites. We were supposed to get along with these people. They're not our people, but we have to get along and be peaceable. Now, Eisenmenger thought that all the invective really did apply at the current time. And he has an interesting theory. He says, listen, we know that the Jews believe in the eternality of their law, the nitzchiyut of the Torah. So all the stuff that they're claiming doesn't apply now, they would concede does apply in messianic times, meaning the totality of the Taryag mitzvot, inclusive of the unpleasantness towards the pagans, is supposed to be employed in messianic times. Well, he says, yeah, if you guys are hoping to do that in the future and you want Messiah to come now, then presumably you're doing a little bit of it as much as you can get away with in the here and now. So if you would kill the heathens when your Messiah arrives en masse, you'll kill a few of them today if you could get away with it. But we're going to catch you. That's what he's claiming.
Is this on religious or racial basis?
Religious. There's nothing racial about this. At least so it seems. This is really all religious. Okay. Now, Eisenmenger believed all the accusations against the Jews, whether they stemmed from folklore or some medieval chronicle. And that's a key point. You have to pick your sources carefully, but you have to be judicious in what you believe. In other words, if you have news coming in from different sources, and some are more reliable than others, so you presumably would be a good curator of information and weed out the shtusim and accept what is more reliable. But that's not his policy. His policy is, even if it's from the most bizarre folkloristic source, let's assume if it's negative about the Jews, it really happened.
He sees Jews only drink blood.
Well, he
Yes. To throw it out.
I understand that, but I think he's a real believer. Now, someone familiar with Jewish literature would find Eisenmenger's interpretations to be a parody, a caricature of a real sefer. They would recognize the brick and mortar of the arguments, the Shaklavataria, but they would find the conclusions bizarre. Meaning, yeah, Eisenmenger knows his stuff, the nuts and bolts, but the conclusions he reaches are crazy. But someone who's uninitiated in Jewish literature would think that it all made sense. Meaning he's citing chapter and verse, and you don't know the truth, you just know that he's citing chapter and verse and seemingly accurately, so presumably his conclusions are also correct. So that's the danger of this book. It could convince people that his version of what Judaism is all about really is the Judaism of his own time. Now, Jews, he said, lie under oath, are disloyal to the state, serve as spies and enemy agents betraying the king. Their Jewish doctors poison children. So these are very serious charges. Now, if that's all true, then maybe expulsion would have been a good idea, which he doesn't call for. So if... Okay, so the answer is that he calls for them to remain within society because he wants them converted. And this is part of traditional church doctrine. His recommendations were fairly moderate, considering what he really believed about them.
If he believes in doctors poisoning children and the wells and everything, what is his Jewish source that would go into his book for that? There are no Jewish sources saying, hey, we got the blood.
Okay, so you're right. But there are various Talmudic passages of, listen, about the Canaanim, about Amalek, about Ovde Kochav Mazalot, Lomalin Vomoridin. There's enough to work with. Goy Shavas Chayav Misa, Goy Shlamator Chayav Misa, Tovim Shebagoyim Laharog, the best of the Gentiles should be killed, which is like the most egregious of all the lines. So there is a body of literature that supports his contention that Jews are barbarous and murderous, specifically about poisoning wells, that no. But in any event, the reason why he's moderate in his suggestions for what should happen to the Jews is because he does believe that the Jews will ultimately convert. If they're kept in a subservient state, if their lives are miserable, and they see that the only salvation for them is baptism and entering Christendom, then maybe they will do it. So like many of his predecessors, whom we've discussed in this course, who were able to convince themselves that if we just pull the right strategy with respect to the Jews, the right combination of a mild degree of tolerance and a whole host of smacking, then they'll come around. Well, he falls into that broad category. So,
$100 million already?
Yeah.
He called Jews that are 5 or 4 or 5 million.
All right, the obsession with the Jews is because the continued existence of the Jews is proof that the religion that they're espousing, Christianity, had yet to win over the people closest to their revered founder. So it's a thorn in their side. Now, if the Jews didn't live in Europe, if they lived in, on the moon or on Mars, and the Christians didn't have to interact with the Jews, probably the zeal for missionary work wouldn't have been as great. But because they were bumping heads all the time, the zeal for missionary work was quite strong. Okay, now, in fairness, Christianity Unmasked, as we said, could have been written, if somebody really wanted to, using the same methodology as Eisenmenger did. But of course, nobody did it because Judaism is a persecuted religion. Now, the big surprise was that Jews were not expelled from everywhere in Europe. And this can be explained by the gap between ideology and practice. And the best example of it is the Prussian king, Frederick William I, who himself published Judaism Unmasked and seemed to have been a big supporter of Eisenmenger and an anti-Jewish character, yet he himself didn't expel his Jews. Why not? He needed them. He needed them for economic gain, for economic reasons. So you can have all sorts of sentiment in your heart, religious fervor, this intensity of the Christian experience and think the worst of the Jews. But if you're tachlis, you need them, you're not going to kick them out. Okay, well, so, the Sons of the Covenant, the B'nai HaBrit, versus the strangers, the Eino Yehudi, in the treatment of the law, is something that was at the core of Eisenmenger's work. Now, the novelty of Eisenmenger was that it was written in German, in a language that people could understand, and there were copious citations. People who wanted to know this information could have known it at an earlier time if they were willing to study Hebrew, but only a small cadre of Christian theologians were willing to go the extra mile studying Hebrew intensely and Aramaic. And so he did them the favor of not only learning it, but putting it into a vernacular. So it was usable for everybody else. Who used this? Who used his work? That's the key question. One, those who opposed the emancipation. So we're talking in the 1780s, 1790s, into the early 1800s, up through basically the Napoleonic Wars. Those who wanted to prevent emancipation would cite Eisenmenger to prove that we have a religious basis to prevent Jewish citizenship in the European states. Then, after those efforts fail, because Jewish emancipation becomes a political reality, who then uses Eisenmenger? Those who want to reverse emancipation, meaning easy come, easy go. All right, we were against the Jews getting emancipation. They got it. Well, let's overturn it. So the Jews have to push back somehow. And David Hatz is asking in the chat, weren't his contemporaries aware of his extended contact with Jews and that he passed as a Jew? So his contemporaries, the Christians, would have felt that, you know, he did everyone a service by concealing his identity and learning as much as he did and producing a great work. So as for whether or not people suspected him of really, you know, being in his heart of hearts an actual Jew because he spent a lot of time with them, I guess not, because his work was so hostile that there was no confusing that. Now, in any event, how do the Jews fight back? Starting from 1711, the Jews have to push back against this. You know, all these claims are being made against us. How do we respond? So the first response is Eisenmenger is pasul le'edut. He's invalid to testify. Why is he invalid to testify? Because of his one-sided approach, meaning that he's not even attempting to be objective in his analysis of the sources, that this is propaganda pure and simple. This is not real scholarship.
In what context do you say pasul le'edut? We're not talking in a Jewish court of law.
No, we mean more generally speaking that you can't rely upon this book because he's a liar. You know, he has an axe to grind and he's not doing this fairly and objectively in a scholarly way.
The blood and all these things, that's what it is.
So that already was argued. And in fact, even the church and the popes accepted these ideas. And we've quoted them, you know.
The fact that the popes claimed any of these things would have been a perfect thing for us to work.
Okay. Now, there were some problematic passages in the old halacha. For example, lanochri tashich. What does that mean? You can charge interest to a goy. Avedato mutar. You have to return a lost object that belonged to a Jew, but if it belonged to a non-Jew, you don't have to. Gezel goy mutar. What does that mean? You're allowed to steal from a non-Jew. So, is that the consensus opinion of the halacha? It's an opinion. It's not the opinion. So let's see. Eisenmenger writes a book, which is a caricature of the halacha. And as Katz says, he has an aspaklarya shena me'ira, a cloudy vision of what Judaism really is. Eisenmenger did not have a historical method, and his ways, ein mukdam u'me'uchar. So we say ein mukdam u'me'uchar b'Torah. There's no chronology in the Torah, no chronological order. Well, there's no chronological order in Eisenmenger's work. It's all a mishmash, all a mishmash. So he takes as equally seriously a Mishnah as he does a work of Darshanut from his own century. If some rabbi wrote it, put it in the book, you know? So he's not utilizing the sources in the correct manner. Now, the Jew of 1700 knew that stealing from a non-Jew was both morally wrong and politically dangerous. What happens if we get caught? They'll kill us. The punishment for theft, the Jew against a Gentile, would be much more severe than a Gentile against a Gentile. So the Jew of 1700 knows we have to be on our best behavior. We can't take any chances. Doesn't matter that the Talmud says Gezel Goy Mutar, we're not going to do it. because it'll be doom and gloom for us if we did. So the Jew knows that. The Jewish scholar looks to, back to the sources to justify his view that Gezel Goy is asur, is forbidden. And even if he can't say that it's forbidden, at least he uses various hermeneutical principles to blunt and to push aside contradictory sources that says that it's permitted. So we know what our agenda is. Our agenda is to make Judaism look good and to be on our best behavior. But a guy like Eisenmenger thinks we're on our worst behavior and only sees sources that say that we're allowed to be on our worst behavior. So there's a dialectical process that we know about that he's not taking seriously. As for stealing from a Gentile, it was a machlokas tanayim. One view said you could do it, one view said you couldn't. The later poskim adopted the strict opinion. You can't steal from a Gentile. What? You know, it's in the Gemara, different opinions. So as for killing a non-Jew, so yes, that was allowed in the Mechias Amalek and the Canaanite wars of conquest. And maybe also in certain cases of Minim or hostile Akum. However, it's easy enough to recast Christians and Muslims as non-idolaters. Oh, they're not Ovdei Kochav Mezalot. They're believers in one God. And therefore they're B'nai Noach. We have to treat them decently, like a Ger Toshev, or just like a Stama person. And we're not going to harm them in any way. Eisenmenger, however, starts from the assumption that what? That the Jews do kill Gentiles for religious purposes. Now, the reality is, or the reality was, that the halacha was becoming increasingly less anti-Gentile between the 16th and 18th centuries. So between about 1500 and 1700, or it was 1500 and 1800, the laws that regulated Jewish-Gentile interactions were being massaged and weakened so as to allow commerce, because the Gemara in Avodah Zarah really forbids a whole lot of stuff that we now do, and we allow it just because we assume these are not really idolaters, but also safeguards were put into place so that Jews could not be accused of deceiving a Gentile business associate or customer. So whereas Talmudic law gave room for, you know, a lot of flexibility that was a little bit immoral against a real idolater, the halakha, as it evolved, eliminated that flexibility. You had to be on your best behavior. You had to be moral in your interactions with everybody else. This is all Ashkenaz, all Ashkenaz. But yet Eisenmenger thought the Jews lived in darkness and were blind to moral considerations, and that they were not getting any better. They were just as bad as they had always been. He did not see any moral improvement in Jewish behavior or in the halakha as codified. Now, what he also did was to cite the Radak on Ovadia chapter 1, verse 20, to prove that Jews regard Germans as the biological descendants of the Canaanim who ought to be killed. So, I mean, this is ridiculous, because if you actually look in that Radak, it's not at all what he says. But here, Eisenmenger is trying to create a race, you know, not a race war, but a nationalistic war between Jews and Germans. So the rabbis tried to neutralize all the old invective, whereas Eisenmenger said that the stuff was not only still applicable, but the Jews were doing it in the here and now. And the worst line of them all, Toshi Bagoyim Harog, kill the best of the heathens, kill the best of the Gentiles. That was a key phrase for Eisenmenger to prove they're out to get us. Doesn't matter how good we are to them, they're going to be bad to us. So now remember, in the Jewish tradition, there is a strand of thought that says, if only we're better than the Gentiles will be better to us. That sort of an internalizing of the critique of Jews, that it's not their bigotry, it's our behavior. And if we change our behavior, they'll change their attitude. In 19th century Europe, in the era of the emancipation, this was a very commonly accepted approach among German and Western European Jews. That, listen, the medieval Jew was sort of this shadowy, dark figure, and we don't want to be that anymore. And we recognize that our people had moral failings, and we're going to elevate ourselves and be worthy of citizenship. So that was a Jewish, you know, sort of a weak-kneed Jewish approach in early modern times.
Is a thought like that something that would encourage conversion to Christianity?
Yes, it would. Yes, it absolutely would, and absolutely did in Berlin between 1770 and 1830 on a large scale. So what I'm saying here is, what Eisenminger is saying is, Tosh Bagoyim Harog, is that it doesn't matter how good we are to the Jew. We could offer them rights, we could, you know, tolerate them, whatever you, however you define tolerance, but it's not going to matter because their hostility is eternal and will not be in any way reduced in its severity. It will not. It will always be strong and active. That's Eisenmenger's key point. Now,
how much of a direct philosophical descendant was Eisenmacher to Martin Luther then?
Okay, so Luther, the question is the relationship between Eisenmenger and Luther. So last week, what I tried to get across with Luther is that he, like many, believed at one time that his agenda for Christianity would be effective in converting Jews. And, you know, that Eisenmenger thinks the same thing. If only we do this or that other thing, we badmouth Judaism, our methods will work in getting Jews to convert. So there's a little overlap there. The difference is Luther then turned against the whole project and just said, oh, these people are terrible and we need to get them out of this country. And they should be persecuted actively with a dramatic reduction in their rights. Eisenmenger calls for a little bit of that, but not as bad as Luther. So in the practical sense, Luther is worse. In the intellectual sense, where is their focus? So the focus of Luther is on the diabolical character of the Jew, which makes him an ancestor of the Nazis, in my view, as opposed to Eisenmenger, who thinks about the diabolical character of Judaism. And so long as Jews are observing the religion of Judaism, they're going to do all sorts of horrible things. If you take away Judaism from them and they were to accept baptism, which he thinks is a real possibility, then all this could go away. So I think that as pernicious of a character as Eisenmenger was, and he's the worst enemy of Judaism of all these writers, he's not as much of a conventional anti-Semite as Luther was. I hope that made some sense, that Eisenmenger's focus is Judaism, less so the Jew as the human being, as the individual.
He's actually moving bullets from what we said.
So it happens to be the case that instinctively, the Jewish community, the Jews, hate Eisenmenger more than they hate Luther, because what do we love? We love our Torah. Okay, we love our Talmud. We love our rabbinic literature. The Jew is the Am HaSefer. We love our books more than anything. And for someone to misuse our books and speak ill of them, that's even worse than speaking ill of ourselves. That it's one thing to say that the Jew is racially diabolical. Okay, we'll not laugh that off, but we'll say, all right, the guy's bonkers. We're a human being just like you are. But to attack our religion and to say it's trash and it's calling for, that is unacceptable. It hits the Jew right in the heart. So I think that's really why the pushback against Eisenmenger was so strong. Now, the last point for tonight, again from Jacob Katz, that Eisenmenger's one false premise leads to many lies. The false premise is that all the things that are said about the Jew are factual. Well, if they're factual, then let's go back to their sources and find that I see here and there, oh, 2,000 years ago, they said something, their rabbi said something, or 5 or 20 things, or 200 things, or 2,000 pages worth of things, that foreshadow all the stuff that is claimed that they're actually doing. So it all fits into a neat package. That one lie, the assumption of the worst, is compounded into 1,000 lies. Okay, I'll take questions. Let me unmute people. One second. Allow business to mute. Okay, you can now unmute if you want.
Okay.
I have a question.
Okay, wait a second. Tina, yeah.
A few but it's inescapable that certain comments that the rabbis made were
on the books.
It's inescapable that there was a line of thinking in ancient Israel about, you know, keeping away from the Gentile world, whether it's Akli Akumim or whether it's the Gentile. I mean, you right. can't escape that, okay? He magnified it. And I think it's a lesson that people had to be very careful what they put in writing on the books, okay? And
yes, so the extreme care about what goes on the printed page is something that the Jew and the Jewish writers would come to appreciate over the centuries, both before the printing press and after the printing press. Now, sometimes this was censorship, which was direct censorship imposed by the Christian authorities, whether the church or the governing authorities, you know, the secular governing authorities. And sometimes it's self-censorship. You realize that you may have a thought in your head that in your mind is the emes l'amito, the truth of truths. But if I write it down, I'm going to be in a heap of trouble. So prudence dictates that I don't write it down.
So for instance, Aleinu. Shehem Odim Mishtachavim Okay, that can get you into a lot of trouble.
And it did.
And it did. You know, with all the censorship. Okay, that's number one. The question of anthropomorphism is a lot of Anim Zmiros.
Yeah.
Oh, of anthropomorphic imagery, metaphoric imagery. Anim Zmiros. Uh-huh. And all that.
Yeah, of course. All right, so there's a lot of it there. You're right.
A lot. Okay. So the question is that I read that I think it was the Gra who said that you don't say it every Shabbos. You say it occasionally.
High holidays only.
Right. Okay. Is that the reason for it?
No, so one of the reasons for limiting Anim Zmiros is because of a Tircha D'Tzib, where people just want to get out and go to the Kiddush. But another reason is because it's considered especially sacred, and anything that's especially sacred ought not to be abused by overusage. So we'll limit it to select occasions when the holiness is palpable, like Yom Kippur.
But it is based on metaphoric language. Completely.
Yeah, sure.
Right, okay.
Okay, anybody else? Any other questions? Oh, we're good.
Just a comment.
See you next week. Your comment. Okay, I'll take
just a comment that I sent you an article that appears in Times of Israel of that they uncovered a synagogue in Spain from the Inquisition time, and they're looking to encourage Jewish tourism there to capitalize on the anti-Semitism of the time.
You can make a buck off of anything.
Go to Auschwitz.
All right, folks. Gotta go. Thanks, next week, Voltaire.
Oh.